So to get here, you had to turn off the alarm, turn down your bed, turn on the shower, turn the toothpaste back over where somebody had left it turned upside down, turn on the ignition, turn the steering wheel, turn the corner, turn into the home, end up turning up here. So that's a lot of turning. And the clock turns, 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 like the wheels on the bus. The whole realm of space and time. Now all of that's just wordplay, but it lays a clear emphasis on the fact that the realm of space and time is for turning, it's for movement. Stillness is a different dimension. So that's where we're starting. The dimensions of time and space are dimensions for turning. But stillness is of a slightly different dimension. Just let that sit there, just for a minute. That the whole realm of space and time, those two dimensions, are dimensions for movement, for turning. But that stillness itself is of a completely different dimension. Now, this is the beginning of our wondering, and these breathing space modules are for wondering, but we'll just let that sit there for a minute and come back to it in a minute. The physical world can never, ever, ever, ever be still. Its essence is movement. Now, it must be so because the scientists even tell us that it's so. Quantum physics tells us that there's no such thing as absolute stillness. There's always a background of quantum noise. If there was stillness, you could know both position and momentum of a particle. And Heisenberg's uncertainty principle has proved that that's impossible. What about space? Is it possible to find stillness in the vastness of empty space? Well, you'd think so. But again, no, you can't. Because if you were going to find stillness in space, you'd need an absolute frame of reference. Now, the supposedly fixed stars used to posit the idea of an absolutely still frame of reference, but such a reference point has been proven not to exist. And the whole realm of modern science, Heisenberg, Niels Bohr, Planck, Schrodinger, Einstein's own theory of relativity is built on the fact that in this physical world of time and space, there is not such a thing as absolute stillness. When it comes to time, people sometimes talk about time standing still. Now, that's simply a mistake of projection. Time can't stand still. What's standing still is the person themselves, a different perception on movement. Somehow or another, the person themselves has stopped moving. But that doesn't mean that their bodies stop moving. Their bodies move, but their being is so fixed in the now, in the present moment, that time doesn't exist for them. So in a very real sense, what they've done is transcended time. So the entire dimension of time and space is for turning. That's what it's for. Now, seeing as this talk is about turning, let's turn that idea around. What if the entire dimension of time and space wasn't for turning, but for returning? T.S. Eliot's got that lovely sequence of lines in Little Gidding. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we first started and know the place for the first time. So what if this turning realm, this moving dimension of space and time, isn't just for turning? What if the whole show is for returning? What if we're not seeing things right? The trouble is that we get so caught up in the turning that we miss the point. And back to T.S. Eliot again. At the still point of the turning world, there the dance is. But neither arrest nor movement, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance. So the proposal is that this entire world isn't just for turning, that it's for the appreciation of the stillness from which all the movement comes. The realization of the stillness, reflected in every turning movement of every turning thing in the turning worlds of time and space. So here it is, that all the turning is a pointer to its source. And the pointers can be infinitely varied in form, but every one of them is a pointer to the source. How many people have seen the Whirling Dervishes dance? Has anybody seen them? The effect of it is profound, because as you saw in that man's face, he wasn't caught up in movement. In 2005, UNESCO proclaimed the Mevlevi Sema ceremony of Turkey, which is what that is. That's what the whirling dervish dance is, as one of the masterpieces of the oral and intangible heritage of humanity. Belongs to mankind. Now, through this practice of what's called Sama, the Sufi dervishes of the Mevlevi order, and they're called Samazens, aim to reach the source of all perfection. The man who originated whirling for the dervishes was Jalal ad-Din Muhammad Rumi. He was probably the finest poet in the Persian language, and some of you will have come across his poetry before. Music and poetry, his love of those is what created the whole idea of the whirling dance. All of his written works are in Persian, but they belong to humanity, just like the works of Shakespeare belong to humanity. The general theme of Rumi's thought is essentially the concept of tawhid, union with the beloved, union with the primal root, from which the aspirant's been cut off and has become aloof, and he has this longing and this desire to unite with it. This is Rumi, out of stillness. I was happy enough to stay still inside the pearl, inside the shell, but the hurricane of experience lashed me out of hiding and made me a wave moving into shore, saying loudly the ocean's secret as I went, and then, spent there, I slept like fog against the cliff. Another stillness. The movement of the dance and poetry like this rouses in us the spirit of wonder. In the Theaetetus, as we probably know, Plato says to young Theaetetus that philosophy begins in wonder. It begins as wondering about things, and in that wondering about things we ask questions. The questions have to be childlike, open, innocent. And as the questions unfold, with persistence, through wondering, we end up in a state of silent wonder, which is a different form of wonder. So philosophy begins and ends in wonder, and the end of wonder is stillness. So this morning we're going to harness some of this wonder to look beyond the excitement of the dance for the still point of the turning world. We're going to look to see where the dance actually is. What happens when we connect with it? What flows from it? we'll start to wonder what life would be like if we realise that dimensions of space and time are not just for turning, but also for returning again and again to the stillness from which all movement comes. Action rests in the rest from which it comes, like the effortless turning of a wheel on its still centre. All the power of action depends entirely, totally, on that stillness. In sport, the runner stands poised and still before the race commences. The diver just waits a moment before leaping. The gymnast gathers himself or herself into a still centre of silent observation and then engages. We've all heard of Nadia Comaneci, 1976 Olympics, first time in Olympic history, scored a perfect 10. Seven times. Just before the London Olympics last year, she was interviewed by the BBC, and she said that she knew she hadn't performed perfectly. She knew. She was watching the routine unfold as her body executed it, and she knew from within that it wasn't perfect. Sri Shantananda Saraswati said, "Every movement in the world has to start from something which is not moving. The whole creation is designed in such a way that it must act. Everything must take part in movement. The obvious or material world is thus busy in action, but within it and around it is another world which is still and allows the movement to take place. Both these worlds can't be moving simultaneously, or else there wouldn't be a world we know and live in. Both these worlds can't be moving simultaneously, or else there wouldn't be a world we know and live in." So without stillness, there's no action. There's only reaction and reaction and reaction. Without beginning in stillness, action is nothing but reaction. But here's the different perspective on this. When stillness acts, artistry begins. When stillness speaks, knowledge shines. When stillness thinks, revelation unfolds. And when stillness feels, bliss opens its arms. Now, these are the four fields we're going to look at very briefly this morning. And the question to ask really is, how can stillness act? How can stillness speak? How can stillness think? How can stillness feel? Surely it's not stillness doing these things, because I do all these things. I'm utterly familiar with my capacity to do these things. I take pride in my ability to do these things. How can stillness do these things? Right action depends on understanding the laws governing the action and so mastering that law that it becomes second nature. It's no longer thought about. There's no gap between conception and execution. It's instantaneous. Once you've mastered that law so that it becomes second nature, you just get out of the way and let the law work. Now, the great artists in all of their fields know this. So talent is one thing, but talent unworked and uninformed can't ever yield artistry. It needs to be informed and it needs to be worked. So what actually gets in the way? I mean, clearly, this is a tennis player with incontestable discipline, extraordinary training, faultless knowledge about the laws governing the action of tennis. Now, age is one thing, but age, again, is natural law. Mr. Federer is getting older. People are beginning to project his demise, and he is. Physical expertise is bound by the natural laws governing the body. But when he gave that interview, he was at his peak, so age wasn't the issue. It wasn't age. He had discipline. He clearly had an understanding of the law, but something got in the way. Now, on the roads, if a car decided to take things into its own hands, there'd be problems. There'd be trouble. Cars do what their drivers tell them to do. Well, do you tell your body what to do? Now, you clearly don't have time to supervise the opening and closing of the heart's ventricles. You can't supervise the individual firing of neurons in the brain. You can't control the flex and counterflex of muscle and tendon. You've been trained to do something else. You're employed to do something else. But the body's also undergone some training. So we start crawling around helplessly on the floor until we learn to walk. And once we've got the drill about walking, it gets into our nature, it becomes naturalized, and it just happens. If it's well trained, the body will follow the laws governing the action so long as something doesn't think it knows better and decides to take things into its own hands. Something thinks it knows better or wants something in particular and takes things into its own hands. Now, that little phantom we call the ego. It's a mind-based sense of I, a stream of thought that's really nothing more than just a spanner in the works. So this spanner in the works gets identified with the action, wants a particular result from the action, and the wanting is so hard that the force driving through the action runs counter to the natural measure of force needed for the action. The flow of the action is interrupted. Claiming like that, disrupting the flow. So usually when you watch Mr. Federer play, he's calm and well contained. In that episode where he threw his racket, I should replay the smash into the net just before he threw his racket down. But you can see his whole, you know how he's fluid and moves easily on the court? He locks. There's sort of like the agenda that he has in moving towards that ball is visible in every movement of his body. There's a rigidity that comes over him. So identified with the action, he wants things to go in a particular way and he loses it. The it is his still center. Now, the same thing happens to us every day of our lives, in the workplace, in our relationships, as we move around, wherever we move. When we lose it, we lose our composure, we lose our sense of self, but more than anything else, we lose our confidence. At the same time, all of our other powers lose their strength. Speech starts to stumble. Stuff that we knew becomes blocked by doubt. Our thinking becomes muddled. We start to feel small and helpless, angry, bitter, and so on. So when we lose it, when we lose ourselves like this, a replacement fills the gap. And that replacement is the phantom ego. So what do we do? What do we do at times like that? Well, the best thing to do is just to step back. Awareness is absolutely everything. If everything was moving, you wouldn't notice movement. You only notice movement because of stillness. The fact that you know movement means that there's something that's not moving. The very fact that you know movement means that there's something not moving, else it couldn't be known. Now, stepping back is sometimes easier said than done. That's why practice is necessary. A practice of awareness can deepen and refine. It can be very precise. But you're aware of the dryness in your mouth. You're aware of the beating heart. you're aware of the sound of your voice. All of those movements, mindful awareness of the state of play, begins to break our identification with the play of action. See the desire for a particular outcome. Seeing it, you can let it go. Let be what comes. Now, this isn't mindless stuff. It's totally mindful. It's not just thinking about things that you see. Like, you can't be in the middle of a temper tantrum and say, yes, I can hear myself yelling. Yes, my throat is getting sore. Yes, that really hurt when I hit the desk like that. You can't, that's mindlessness. This awareness has to be a deeper thing, a purer kind of witnessing. Now, if you practice this, it starts to flower. And stillness becomes more and more accessible. Now, it might be difficult practicing this with people to start with. People always present a difficulty. So you could start it with objects. Watch a tree in a breeze. So I was standing on a balcony a couple of days ago, and there was this sort of very full-grown bush there. A breeze was blowing through it. The leaves were trembling. There was something about the measure of movement in the trembling of those leaves that arrested the attention. And the branch it was on was moving just so much, not too far, just so much. And the trunk itself was swaying ever so slightly. But what was coordinating all of that, what was holding the measure of it, was the root. And it was still. If you connect with the root, then the glistening play of the breeze through the leaves, the bend of the branch, the arch of the trunk, they're all beautiful. Disconnected from the root, and such movement might not even be noticed. So you let the movement be. What we hardly ever do is connect with the root. If we see anything, we see the movement. So maybe this whole world of turning is for returning. Connect with the root. Connect with the stillness. And everything else shines just so beautifully. So that connection with the root magnified the beauty of the tree. I can still see it, and I won't forget it. And we've all had experiences like this. It's just a tree. But it was the connection with the root that let the beauty of the swaying branch and the trembling leaves shine like that. So the movement reflects the beauty, but the beauty is in the root. In the firm unmovingness of the root. Forget or ignore the root, and all one's perceptions are caught in the movement. So in the same way, what we're practicing with awareness is connecting with our witnessing self, this bystander in a way. You watch the body limbs like you watch the branches. Watch the mind and the heart like watching the trembling leaves. Watch and enjoy the movement without becoming branch or leaf or trunk. You just remain in yourself. In this way, stillness acts. And when stillness acts, artistry unfolds. So that's our first facet. The second facet is speech. When stillness speaks, knowledge shines. Now, whether or not that was stillness speaking is something worth inquiring into. It's not the subject of this morning's talk. But that conveys the power of words. Now, for some people, that's incredibly irritating, that clip. Some people find it offensive because it invades them with a sort of demagoguery, a rhetorical bellowing that they find offensive to their sensibilities. Some people really like it. Some people are inspired by it. The fact is that the power of words is extraordinary. Our world is full of speech, and the advertising industry celebrates the power of words in the most extraordinary way, where words are used to catapult you into action. Nike, just do it. I think, therefore, IBM. Oh, the Calvin Klein one. Between love and madness lies obsession. Johnny Walker, keep walking. Toyota, oh, what a feeling. All of these slogans are meant to catapult us into action. Language is the most remarkable thing. Words can uplift, inspire, unite, motivate. They can also rattle our nerves. They can kill our desire. And words, simple words, can totally destroy our self-confidence. Just a word. But a word can also dissolve pain. When selfishness speaks, division grows. When love speaks, hearts grow strong. When stillness speaks, knowledge shines. How can stillness speak? Well, it happens all the time. How often have you been in the middle of a conversation with somebody and the flow of speech is going on and you forget something and you need to remember it? So what do? You turn slightly away from the speech. You might tilt your head down. You might even close your eyes to go inward. Everything about the body and the mind and its limbs is moving to some point. Now, Shantananda Saraswati said that this is very much like diving into a deep sea. We're trying to get to the point where the knowledge would appear. We're all familiar with this. He says it's very much like diving into a deep sea. One collects all limbs, collects all senses, and dives into that stillness which is vast, like an ocean, and it all goes to a point. Nothing like a physical point. It's a point, but it's all embracing. How often have you found it impossible to speak without gathering your thoughts? We have this notion of gathering our thoughts. What we're actually doing isn't gathering our thoughts. We're trying to abandon our thoughts so that they don't deafen us, so that we can hear the words as they arise. We're listening for the stillness. Now, there are loads of exercises in many traditions for reconnecting to the source of stillness across all the fields of human activity. Keeping speech to a minimum is one such practice. So you might go on a retreat and it's a silent retreat. We could practice this during the coffee break. You shouldn't be selective about practicing it. You need to be universal. You can't decide not to speak to some people, but to speak to other people. But you could practice it during the coffee break. Now, this would lead a certain surreal atmosphere. But there is another way. You could undertake a resolution to use only that speech which has three characteristics. Speech which causes no excitement, which is pleasing, and which is beneficial. Now, this is the way of restraint. This threefold characteristic of pure speech was given by Krishna to Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Three simple characteristics. It doesn't cause excitement, it's pleasing, and it's beneficial. And it's not just pleasing to you, it's pleasing to everybody. And it's not just beneficial for you, it's beneficial for everybody. Causes no excitement, is pleasing and beneficial. Now, we could take these rules and we could practice them in two ways. These three rules. We could decide to master the rules and become absolutely proficient in the rules and let the rules rule. So everything that we say, we take through the filter system of, has it got these characteristics? Is it causing excitement? Is it beneficial to everybody? Is it pleasing? You could ask yourself about this, but it creates a problem because the rules become rigid. You might somehow become mindless in following the rules. The rules are just pointers. They're pointers. They're not meant to be tyrants They're pointers. Whether or not the speech has these characteristics is revealed in a much less muscular way by listening. And you can do this in a very systematic but very gentle way. Start by listening to the sound of your own voice as you're speaking. Listen to the sound of the other person who's speaking. Now, this has got an immediate advantage because you actually start to hear what they're saying to start with. So it helps the relationship. But as your listening deepens, your awareness starts to broaden. It'll open up. First thing is patience will grow. You'll become more patient with yourself and stop interrupting, and you'll become patient with the person that you're speaking with. And with patience, there'll be deepening of self-awareness. So the thought streams in the mind will start to fall away. And as you listen, you'll be prepared to wait upon stillness. And the glorious thing is, you'll start to hear speech rising from stillness. And to top it off, the threefold characteristic of speech arising from stillness is that it causes no excitement, that it's pleasing to all, and that it's beneficial for everybody. So you could try that during the coffee break. Because when that happens, knowledge begins to shine. When stillness speaks, knowledge shines. So this brings us to our third field of movement. So far, when stillness acts, artistry unfolds. When stillness speaks, knowledge shines. When stillness thinks, revelation unfolds. Now, how can stillness think? Consider this. Where does inspiration come from? Where does it come from? We might attribute a causal relationship to some object. But inspiration, true inspiration, isn't caused by an object. It rises, it appears, it just manifests, it's revealed. Inspiration comes from spirit. That's what the word means. It comes from stillness. This is stillness thinking. Have you ever slept on a problem to find it resolved when you woke up? Have you ever experienced an idea breaking upon you with such brilliance that it fills you with energy? And it doesn't have to be your idea or somebody else's idea. As a matter of fact, the last thing you do is identify the idea with a particular person. You just say, that's brilliant. And it breaks upon you and releases energy. Everyone appreciates the brilliance, and nobody would lay claim to it. But of course, you can. You could lay claim on it. You could put a copyright notice on it. But that would be theft. True knowledge is revealed in thought. And it doesn't belong to anyone. It belongs to everyone. It's a human birthright. And no one can rightfully claim it as their own personal possession. And that's why true knowledge can never be bought and sold. The greatest truths revealed to mankind are authorless. They have emerged from stillness itself as pure forms of the still field of consciousness. Stillness is one and universal, like the stillness of the ocean depths. Now, you can think otherwise, of course. We can all think otherwise. We're all free to do that, and we can think things up ourselves. But it's a sort of madness, because before you've thought it up, stillness has lent it to you. Where else has it come from? Real thinking isn't the stuff that usually fills our head. That's a lower-level activity going on, and it's mental speech. Now, how about the idea of hearing all of your mental speech and bringing those rules of physical speech to bear on them? How about banishing every thought that causes excitement, Not so tasty, that idea. Banishing every thought that is displeasing in some way. Think of all those nasty, lovely, sweet, nasty little thoughts you have about other people. Banishing every thought that isn't beneficial. Now, if you exercise those rules in the realm of mental speech, you might end up with a clear head. You'd certainly end up with a clean mind. The oldest poem in the classical Western tradition is Homer's Iliad. And he begins by invoking the power of the muse to write it for him. He says, "Sing, O goddess, of the anger of Achilles, son of Peleus, that brought countless ills upon the Achaeans." Now note the opening. He's not claiming authorship. He's surrendering to the goddess. Now that Greek, the original Greek word that word goddess has been translated as, the original Greek word is thea, feminine form of goddess. And it means a seeing or a looking at. The goddess that Homer is invoking is the universal power of revelation. He might as well say, may the power of revelation tell us a story. Or he might as well say, sing, O stillness, of the anger of Achilles, son of Peleus. The ancient sages of India were called rishis. The word comes from the root drish, to see, hence the translation seers. And the ancient Upanishads are called shruti, or revelations. They were revealed to the seers by the light of consciousness. They're authorless. They came from stillness. They came from stillness. This is the way the world began. Scientists call it the Big Bang. It came from stillness. What we study is the bang and forget the stillness. Whereas connection with the stillness will illuminate the mechanics, the laws of the bang. When stillness acts, artistry begins. When stillness speaks, knowledge shines. When stillness thinks, revelation unfolds. When stillness feels, bliss opens its arms. How can stillness feel? Feelings run deep. So deep that they're past the realm of thought. Everybody here feels human. And that's a deep feeling. This isn't the turgid activity of hurt feelings, although that comes into it, because if somebody calls you a pig, rather than the hurt feeling, what rises is the feeling of being human to counter it. And that might be translated into an emotive reaction. But the feeling of being human is embedded in our very bones. Your behaviour might be beastly, but the feeling of being human never leaves you. Now, beyond this feeling, which is deep, beyond this feeling of being human, there's another feeling, a deeper feeling, which can be stirred. It's a feeling of being something more than we've ever realised. And it shows itself in everything that we do as a yearning for largeness, for freedom, for fullness of life, for true happiness. It's not the absence of these three that we feel. This is our turnaround in thinking again. Up here in the headspace, we think they're not there, we've got to go and get them. They're driving us, those desires. But the feeling of being these things, so deeply embedded in our nature, is drawing us. Lovingly drawing us. And it will never stop drawing us. It's always there with us, this feeling. And it's a feeling of the vast stillness of pure consciousness. Other things drive us, desires and fears and all the rest, but this is constantly drawing us. In stillness, it reveals itself. And it's like a kind of memory, like a kind of recognition. It's as if we forgot ourselves for a moment and then remembered who we really were. So it's time, I think, to take a refreshment break. But before we do, just to draw this to a final close, the subtitle of the talk is Turning on Stillness. And we started with a few lines from T.S. Eliot. The main idea is to turn around the notion that the three dimensions, the two dimensions, or dimensions of time and space are for turning, they're for returning. And to reconsider every impulse that we have in its larger perspective, as coming from stillness, drawing us to stillness. So we started with these four lines from T.S. Eliot's poem, Four Lines on Exploration, and we'll finish with the line just before, which is really beautiful. With the drawing of this love and the voice of this calling, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of our exploring will be to arrive where we first started, and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown, unremembered gate, when the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning. Heard, half heard, in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick, now, here, now, always. A condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And I think this has run its course. So we'll have some coffee and tea and then we'll come back for any questions or points that you'd like to raise. All right, thank you very much.